This episode is brought to you by the Slash and Cast Podcast Network. Learn more at slashandcast.net.
Yeah, you cut me too deep. I think I'm dying here, man.
Welcome to the 3B Video Deep Cut Podcast.
Watch a few movies, take a few notes.
It was fun.
Aw, yeah. It's that time again for another bi-weekly episode of the Deep Cut Podcast with your hosts, Rotten Roger DeMarco and...
It's just too early to be doing this. This is evil.
And...
We'll let the special guest go.
Oh, okay. The special guest. We have a special guest this week. And...
Oh, is this the part I'm supposed to talk?
Yeah, oh, sure.
Oh,
go
my
ahead.
God. I'm so sorry. Yeah, I'm Patrick Ray. I'm here from Kansas City. Great to be here.
Woo-hoo. And
I'm just kinda chilling here, making sure things go right.
He's the young Jamie to my Joe Rogan. Push the buttons, twist the knobs, look the things up, Mr. Remix. But that's right. Here we are again, breaking from our normal format of discussing one film in particular. This is kind of a special episode for me. I might just cry.
Oh boy.
That's all right. We can't see it, so.
That's right. We got the camera off.
It flow.
You can't see me. We reached out to our good buddy, Patrick Ray, a filmmaker in Kansas City, and we just wanted to sit down and chop it up with this fantastic little indie film director. So here we are.
I am excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. So, the way we normally do this is we usually pick a specific movie and then we kind of ramble and rant about the things we love for about 40 minutes. And then we go into some other little skits about said movie. But since we just have you, I figured we would just, let the listeners know a little something about you.
Yeah, so, totally.
If you want to, give a little introduction to
yourself.
Yeah,
absolutely.
A little background.
I'm originally from Nebraska, and I grew up in a very small town, eventually went to film school at the University of Kansas. Kevin Wilmot was one of my professors. He wrote the movie Black Klansman and recently The Five Bloods. So I worked on his first feature, or actually it was his second feature called CSA, spent a lot of time living in Lawrence, Kansas, and started making films. And eventually I started making a lot of short films. They were playing at festivals like Shriek Fest and Scream Fest and the New York City Horror Film Festival. And then I made a feature film called Nailbiter, which I think was finally released in 2013. That movie took like 4 years to get done.
Where's that sequel, Patrick?
I know. Well, that's a whole other conversation that we can have. So Lionsgate ended up releasing it in 2013, the Redbox, and for a while it was playing on Chiller, which was that horror channel that was NBC Universal's kind of sister station to Sci-Fi, and I think it ended up closing up shop in 2017.
I love Chiller.
Dude, it used to play Freddy's Nightmares, man.
Right, it was great, and they had our movie on regularly, which was great, and then that went away, and then I ended up making another film, and I shot it in South Carolina, titled Enclosure. At the time, it was titled Enclosure, and it starred Fiona Dourif, Jake Busey, and we shot the whole thing in like 12 days in South Carolina. The distributor ended up retitling it Arbor Demon, which I will never get over. But someday I'll make peace with it. But the movie's like on Epix right now, and iTunes, and it's on just about every digital platform you can think of.
I think we had a conversation about that at one point. Like the distributors, it had something to do with
A, the letter A,
starting
yes,
with A.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was one of those things where around 2016-17. The movie premiered at Fright Fest in the UK and got a very warm reception there, and it ended up getting picked up, and I was excited about it. And then about, I don't know, September, October, they decided they were going to change the title, and they gave me the option of sending them, various titles that start with A or B, just because at the time, like, they were doing this thing called Alpha, I can't remember what the exact word was for it, but it was basically... At the time, VOD was alphabetized, And anything that started with an A was getting a lot more rentals. They were showing me basically, you know, proof of this, that like A's were getting exponentially more views than anything below that. So
appealing to the lazy people, being like, I don't want to scroll through all these fucking letters.
Right. I went along with it, and I wasn't happy with the title, and I sent them a lot of different options. But I mean, that thing is everywhere right now in terms of digital platforms. I mean, it's on, you know, it was on Hulu for a year. And then, now it's on Redbox On Demand. It's on Vudu right now for free with ads. So, you know, it got out there and I was very pleased. You know, especially the shooting a movie in 12 days, you know, it was like 6 days on, one day off, 6 days on. And it was just, I remember when we were shooting it, it was weird because it was in South Carolina and it was in December. So it was like, the thing that was the most challenging about it was we were shooting in the woods. And you don't have that many daylight hours in December, right?
Right.
So they wanted to make the movie more set during the day. So we rewrote the script to accommodate. And, you know, it was like, okay, 7 a.m., the sun is up. And we really only had to like 3:30 in the afternoon before the sun looked completely different because it was on the other side of the woods. So there was one day in particular, we ended up having like a very long production day, way too long. And they had to light the woods with condor lights to make it look like it was still daytime. I mean, we were clearly at night, and it was just like, oh, we just, you can't tell in the movie because it's like it's one of the major scenes in the movie, but it's nighttime, but we made it look like it was day.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so I mean, those are the kind of things that, you know, but most of the movie was shot very, very claustrophobic style in a tent. And we did it all on a soundstage, and that part was cool, and we could control the light, and you know, it was a good experience. It just very, very quick, you know, and it was my first time making a movie that fast because I had just done Nailbiter, which felt like it was an endless nonstop. Like it took years. We ran out of money halfway through. We had to come back and shoot more a year later with Monster. And it was just like this nonstop thing to make it look like it was all shot at one time. And this was like, you know, I flew in, you know, before Thanksgiving and left the day before Christmas. And it was like, it was done, you know? You know, and then after I made that film, I made a family film, which Dustin worked on. And I we shot that in Kansas City. And that was just a completely about face for me, which it was fine. I was excited about it. And I was really glad that I got to make something that my kids could actually watch, you know?
So inquiring minds want to know, Evil brought this up.
Yeah.
Why did you cut me out with the shotgun in my face?
Some negative reaction, not to you, but just the idea that grandma had a shotgun aimed at somebody. It was like, and it felt so out
it
of,
turns to a Charles Bronson and, flick
right,
real
it
quick.
It felt so out of place. That I was it crushed me, but I was just like, I had to, because it was like one of those things where people are like, okay, that just totally sunk the whole, you know, and people were having problems with the dad having a gun at the end, and I was like, we have to keep that, otherwise I actually had a distributor contact me and they said, we love your movie, is there any way you can recut it at the end where the dad doesn't have a gun? I'm like, no, because it's just isn't
you gotta shoot the bad guy in the arm.
Am I gonna do the CGI ET thing where we put a walkie talkie in his hand? Like, I can't do that. So you know, it was just one of those things where we just had to make the decision. And
you
originally,
that Rambo thing
and originally
turn
like
trying to gun into a thumbs up.
Right. And originally all the parents showed up with guns and I was in the script and I was just like,
that's Predator 2.
Oh, man. I was just like, this is going to get me in so much trouble. So we shot that 2016 and part of 2017. Cause we ended up shooting a little bit more.
You guys did some pickup.
I edited the movie, and I felt like there was a couple things that needed to be added, so we went back in 2017. And that movie was that movie's on the Up Family Network's streaming service right now, and it's done pretty well. It's on Vudu again. It's on Vudu for free with ads. It's on Tubi. I think Arbor Demon's on Tubi as well.
I think so.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. Do you guys watch a lot of Tubi?
I think Evil uses Tubi, or Evil's wife uses.
Yeah, Tubi. she uses Tubi a good amount. I once in a great while will cruise through it.
It's there's so much that it becomes overwhelming. That's my problem with that. I was just like I could spend an hour and a half just looking for something to watch.
Yeah, that's what happens every time I come into my basement.
Right, exactly. So you know, that movie ended up doing pretty well. You know, it was that was my first movie that I could point to on the Walmart shelf, which was kind of cool. And then I started working on the Nailbiter sequel actually, and then it became a thing where raising money for the sequel has become it was very challenging.
Did you do a Kickstarter?
No, and I may still do it. I just keep getting I had another project kind of fall in my lap, and so let's say 2019, actually early 2019, I started helping out on a film called it was called Inhumane at the time, and then we ended up it just started kind of morphing into what became I Am Lisa, which was. Out of all the features I've done, this one was like the smallest budget. In fact, I think it was probably 1/4 the budget of Enclosure or Arbor Demon. And we shot it 14 days here in Kansas City in 2019 in the summer, which was like the sweltering. There were several several days where they were like, don't go outside if you don't have to. And I was like, well, our schedule says we're shooting outside. We have no choice.
Bring your sunblock.
Well, and we were in the woods, so luckily it was one of those things where it didn't quite feel like 105 in the woods, you know, because you're in the shade. And we were right next to a house, so we could run inside and cool off if we needed to. But anyway, so we shot that movie in 14 days. It became I Am Lisa. And then that movie premiered first at the drive-in here in Kansas City. Cause it's kind of a drive-in movie. We ended up getting like, this was during the pandemic, but people were so excited about seeing a movie outside. So we had like 340 cars show up that night.
Nice.
It was insane. I was like super, that was probably the most anxiety I've ever felt at a screening. Cause it's one of those things where you know, I've been editing it in my boxer shorts in the basement for like, you know.
I know all about editing
months.
In my boxer
right,
shorts in
the right,
basement.
Right. So, you know, and all of a sudden you're showing it to, you know, a bunch of people at the drive-in. And obviously, you know, it's one of those things where you work really hard to get the sound right. You work really hard. And you know that the presentation to the drive-in is going to be a drive-in presentation. I always say you're going to see the movie, but you're going to kind of, it's going to be a little bit distorted because, you know, people with their headlights. You got people walking around, you got the train going by, you know, mm-hmm. And but it went over very well. And then we ended up having our festival premiere at Fright Fest in the UK again. And that was virtual last year. But I was excited that they chose the film. And then we signed with a distributor and it was this very staggered release with the movie. So they released the movie on like it was digital cinema. So they did like an October digital cinema release. And then they did Redbox in January, and then DVD Blu-ray in March. And so we've been on the Walmart shelves. I've heard that we've sold, I think it's probably close to 6,000 copies so far at Walmart. And so
nice. See, my Walmart has not carried it yet because every time I go, I look and I'm like, "All right, I got."
That's strange, but I don't know. It's done pretty well, and so you know.
Now, when you were getting ready for distribution with that, has there, like, because the landscape has changed so much, is there like, any talk of, like, well, just go digital, don't go physical? Is that a thing that they're saying to you?
You know, here's the thing. Not with horror. I think that there's such a demand for physical media from the horror crowd. You've got a lot of boutique companies. You've got, like, mm-hmm. Arrow. You've got... Scream Team, you've got Scream Factory. I think that those movies will always have a demand for physical media. But I think when it's coming to other, like perhaps other genres, I've heard rumors that they're just going to start doing just streaming because it's tough to sell DVDs if it's not like, you know, Walmart, for instance, it seems like they have a lot of horror, a lot of indie horror, mm-hmm. and a lot of faith-based films.
Yeah.
So, you know, Belong to Us, which isn't, I wouldn't call it a faith-based film, but it is a family film with a message, I think sold pretty well at Walmart because there's always a demand for that. But yeah, like, I think that, I do think that we're pushing in a direction where everything is going to be streaming or digital, which is, for me, is tragic.
Yeah, it's terrible. I'm not looking forward to it. I get asked probably at least once a week, someone will message me that follows our podcast or follows our YouTube channel and asks, like, how soon do you think physical media will be dead? And I'm
Thursday.
Yeah, literally, like, before next year.
Well,
I saw
an article circulating online about Warner Brothers discontinuing physical media, but I don't know if there was any truth to that, because I saw an article, it got circulated on Facebook, but then I didn't see anything else about it. So I don't know. I feel like that's like a major headline, you know, like I feel like that's something that would be in Variety or, you know, Deadline,
be all over the place.
So I don't know. Like, I think that's it. We're moving in that direction, but it's upsetting because, like, I took my daughter to Walmart and just showed her the DVD on the shelf, and she, you know, she was always kind of playing in the basement while I was editing, and she was on set several days, so she saw kind of the, you know, the how it began from just a conversation to it being on the Walmart shelf. And I told her, I said, you know, she wants to be a director. She had a career day and dressed up as me for career day. Minus the beard. Like, she put on glasses, and then I gave her a clapper, and then I gave her like a lanyard from a film festival. And so she went to school. It was adorable. But anyway, I told her, amazing. I said, yeah, well, most likely by the time you make a movie, this won't exist.
Here. Right, which is, it's, you know? It's tragic, which I try to raise my kids, and Evil does the same thing with, like, the importance of physical media.
Well, right, it's a tangible thing. I always say, like, I want, as long as I can, and I told the distributor this, is as long as I can, I want at least a DVD, or a Blu-ray, or, you know, if we can get both, that would be fantastic, so that, you know, you can hold it in your hand. Like, what if, I always say, you know, the day that all of the internet disappears, what happens, you know? Like, I don't know.
Or
like,
what if, you know, your distribution rights or whatever goes wrong? Like, look at, like, weird stuff too, like that Evil and I always point out with Nightmare on Elm Street 3. Like, if you have the original VHS of Nightmare on Elm Street 3, like, the beginning when she's making the papier-mâché house.
It's a different song. It's
Quiet Cool by Joe Lamont. Yeah. And then,
you
know, for whatever reason, the rights go away. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's docking into the fire. Yeah. And you hear, every time I hear it, I go, bullshit, wrong, false.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, right. I have the, I think what I bought that VHS from Suncoast, like, when I was in, man, I probably was in junior high. So I have the original because it's an old VHS. It's like, I think it's got it actually has the original poster on it, as opposed to, like,
All those reprints.
So, it's funny. I have a vivid memory of I took a walk with my dad in Columbus, Nebraska, and we walked past the movie theater, and that movie was playing, and I just stared at the poster, and then I went home and I started drawing the poster. you know, it's one of those things where, like, as a kid, you know, I was a kid in the 80s, and so Freddy was just kind of, like, splashed everywhere, like, in the grocery store or whatever, and it was like, you know, my parents are like, you're going to rent Short Circuit. I'm like, no, I want Nightmare on Elm Street 2. You know, and it's just one of those things where I think that's...
Because we're like the same age, I believe.
Close. I was born in January of 80.
Oh, okay. I was born in 84. But, I mean, we're both from kind of a small town.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you, so in the small town that you grew up in, was there was a movie theater and there was a video store or no?
Yes. So the movie theater in my hometown had a video store inside of it. So it was two screens, and then in the lobby, the big lobby was all a video store.
Yes.
So we went there every weekend and rented movies. And it was just one of those things where I would come home with a stack we would rent Silent Night, Deadly Night a lot for some reason. I think Creepshow 2. Those are the two that we rented the most. You know, they had that horror section at the video store right next to the bathroom, so that, like, when somebody would go to the bathroom, that the smell would leak right over the horror section. Anyway, it was So I was like, I remember
piss and popcorn.
I remember particularly the ones that were really high up in the bigger boxes. Like that was the thing that was kind of like, whoa, those are must be really scary because they're in bigger boxes.
Big box.
And then they had Sleepaway Camp 2. I would always be looking at because it was like this weird cover where it was a girl who wasn't in the movie, but she was wearing a backpack, but she had like Freddy's glove and Jason's mask hanging out of it. That was the cover for Sleepaway Camp 2. I'd have to look it up, but like I vividly remember that. But yeah, one of my favorite memories was I was 7 and I went to see Spaceballs, and it was next door to RoboCop, and I was pissed. I was pissed because I wanted to see RoboCop, even though both of them now are kind of classics, and you know what I'm saying. But that was kind of like I remember specifically loving RoboCop, even though it was like this hardcore R-rated movie. And so then by the time RoboCop 2 came out, that was like my first R-rated movie in the theater because I begged my dad to take me and he finally caved. So summer 1990 was kind of like for me like the summer where all of a sudden I was going to all these R-rated movies because I saw Die Hard 2 that summer at the drive-in. And then I remember later I saw Predator 2. So it was like that. So 1990 for me was kind of like this, you know, and I was 10, almost 11 at that time. And it was kind of like, I felt like a big kid at that point. So,
That's an amazing summer of cinema, man.
Yeah, I remember Dick Tracy. I saw that there because I was supposed to see it at the drive-in, but it rained, so we went and saw it. For some reason, my hometown in Schuyler, Nebraska, had Dick Tracy opening night.
Wow!
In this tiny theater, and I remember thinking it was weird, man. Like he would get like opening night, he would get the James Bond movie. So GoldenEye opening night, I saw in my like hometown theater, in the small town. It was just like so odd. He must have had a deal with MGM or something where he got those movies opening night. But yeah, it was cool. We had multiple video stores. One of them was kind of an arcade. When I was in junior high, it was like one half of the place was an arcade. It had Street Fighter 2 and all those games, and then the other half was a video store. And then we had another one. And they got used to me coming in and renting movies that were not for me. You know,
like, they knew you by name.
So I would walk in and I'd be like, "Hey, I'm gonna rent Nightmare on Elm Street 5," and they're like, "Okay," and I'm like 12. I'm just signing off on it. Yeah, like score. Yeah. So, you know, those are the things. The thing I liked about the Nightmare on Elm Street posters is that they're like works of art, you know? And they don't make horror movie posters like that anymore, right? Like, so, like...
They don't at all.
So, I just remember vividly always walking... Every time there was a Nightmare on Elm Street sequel and it would play in my hometown, I would just stare at the poster. Like, I would just stare at it and be like, this is amazing artwork for these movies. And so, it kind of makes me sad now. Everything's kind of photoshopped and... when we did I Am Lisa, I mean, it's a very, very micro budget movie, but I wanted to make a poster that was kind of more painted looking. And so we ended up, that was our first poster that kind of started circulating, was a little bit more classic horror looking. But before we went to the Photoshop DVD cover.
Right. Yeah. With a bunch of floating heads. Right. We did the exact same thing for our micro budget movie. It was like my artist. And I had, you know, been talking about a bunch of different Devin Whitehead art and just the old box art. Like, you know, you see like Terror Vision and the Creepshow movies and you're like, these are beautiful.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
They make you want to rent the movie.
Right.
And sometimes the movie wasn't reflective of the art at all, you know.
Right.
But so I had my artist, I was like, just do whatever you want, just, you know, give it that old school feel.
Right.
And he went with oil paint and gave us this you know, the poster is most likely going to be better than the movie.
I mean, I'm in it, so clearly that's going to be the case.
It sells the movie, and that's the thing, is it's like, it's important for something to be eye-catching, and, you know, look at the Scream Factory Blu-rays that they put out where they have somebody specifically make the artwork for them. Like, it's like, oh my God. Like, I'm always disappointed when they have one that they just kept the original poster.
Let's just go ahead and call them out. Man's Best Friend with their fucking garbage cover art.
Yeah, well, or Graveyard Shift. I was really hoping for a really neat poster for that one. But then, they have like the Prince of Darkness one is fantastic. They did a fantastic job with that. Like certain ones that they really... did you ever, as a kid, were you ever confused by the Friday the 13th Part 5 video cover? I was always confused. I'm like, why is it not the hockey mask that he's wearing in the movie. I'm looking at the Nika toy right now, and I'm like, why? Why did they do that? Why did they go with that? Because it doesn't make any sense.
I have a very, like, that movie used to trick me every time, because we didn't have a video store, but we had a grocery store that had movies.
Sure.
And, like, when I was in elementary school, my aunt, she would always be like, if you bring me home, like, if you show me you got an A on a spelling test or whatever, I'll take you up to the store and let you rent a movie. And I remember seeing Friday the 13th Part 4 when I was real little, but we didn't own it.
Yeah.
And so every time she would be like, I'll let you rent a movie, I would grab Friday 5, I'd flip it over, and there was like a picture of Corey Feldman. I'm like, he's the kid. That's the kid. Yeah. This is the movie where the kid fights Jason. So I'd rent it, and I'd go home, and I'd be like, son of a bitch, he's only in the first like 2 minutes.
No.
And then a year would go by, and I'd be like, I'd be back at the store, and I'd go, there he is, he's on the back, and I'd rent it, and I'd go, son of a bitch, every, you know, like, it would get me over and over again.
You're like the police of Camp Crystal Lake, like, we killed him, he's dead, damn it, he's still alive.
I used to go to the grocery store video section, and I would do this thing where the Friday the 13th movies were spread out all over the rental area, and I would, like, I would put them in order. I would put them on the shelf in order so that, like, they were, you know, I think back to that. I'm like, that's such a strange. I imagine the video store guy going, what is that kid doing? Why is he doing that?
He did that shit.
Future video store.
He did that shit on purpose. He's like, just throw it on a shelf anywhere. This kid will come in. He'll organize it all for us.
I would walk around. I'm like, where's part 3? I have to find it. So then I would walk around the video store and I'd try to find it, and I would put it in the order of the.
That's free child labor right there is what that is.
Oh, I know.
Come to find out, that guy had a number system, so you were just fucking up his whole shit.
So I remember specifically the first time I watched Friday the 13th Part 5. God, I don't know what year it was, but I had my own TV, and I had, you know, antennas for the... And we could pick up Cinemax.
Oh,
but
shit.
Only slightly. So it was like this... It had the scan lines, and it would beep.
Super fuzzy, yeah.
Yeah, so I had sat there and I watched it through the scan lines. I'm like, what is this? And then I was like, oh my god, what is it? And that movie is probably the sleaziest of all the Friday 13th movies. I mean, I think it's great, but it's the sleaziest. Yeah. And
100% super sleazy.
So I later read about the director's filmography, and I'm like, that makes sense. I get it.
Yeah.
But
Danny Steinman, yeah, right? He was
Danny
a porn Stan- director.
Yeah, he did some 70s, yeah. Porn. So
we've got Bush.
And I just remember thinking, I watched it all the way to the end where, like, it was like, you know, fell on the spikes, and I was just like, man, it scared me. But you know, so that one's kind of always had a special place in my heart. But most of the ones I saw originally on USA, which was like USA Network was my favorite place to be on the weekends, because they would play all these. In the middle of the day, they'd be playing Friday the 13th. But the thing is, like, they would be like, "Oh, we're just gonna cut all the gore out and all the you know, nudity," and it would just be watching basically a very PG-13 version of those movies. But
yeah, imagine a TV edit of Friday the 13th Part 7. It's already watered down.
Right.
40 minutes of commercials.
Right. So I found my VHS tape from '95. I would be in high school at this point, but I recorded a USA Up All Night marathon of Friday 13th, I think 3, 4, and 5. No, wasn't that 4 never aired. I was always mad. It was always 3, 5, and 7. At least it was this time, but the VHS tape doesn't work. So I had to find somebody to fix it. So,
is it moldy? Is that,
no,
is that what's up?
No, what happened was I rewound it, and then the end of it, like, doesn't move forward.
Oh no!
So I just need somebody to fix it, but I figure, you know, at least I couldn't find the tape for the longest time, and I found it. So, but I have like a bunch of USA Up All Night or USA Network stuff recorded from the early '90s.
Rhonda Shear or Gilbert Gottfried?
A little bit of both. The Friday the 13th marathon was Rhonda, and I have a Halloween 2 from '94 on Halloween weekend.
I bet the commercials on that are fucking funny.
Yeah, most of them. I remember, like, as a teenager, I was always like, wow, there's a lot of phone sex commercials on this channel. And my buddies and I would try to call, but then what? The second they ask for your credit card, we're like, "Oh, hang up." But like,
quick.
Yeah. So it's just one of those things where, you know, I grew up on that, and obviously the original airings of Joe Bob on TNT, which is why I'm so into Joe Bob now on Shudder, I feel like if you grew up in the 80s as a kid and then you were a teenager in the 90s, you kind of got the best of the both worlds, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the biggest things that kind of pushed me into filmmaking was that my high school had its own channel.
Nice. Yeah, I was going to ask you about how old were you when you were like, you know what, I think I'm going to take a crack at making movies.
Well,
like, what pushed you over that edge?
I would tell kids when I was a kid, like I'm talking like 7 or 8 years old, I would tell kids, I'm going to make movies. And they're like, whatever, dude. I would be, you know, imagining, but they were all like, I'm Masters of the Universe movie. I'm going to be like I have all my He-Man toys and stuff like that. I would say probably high school is when I really started doing it. I would make these little videos in my high school and then air them, because I was kind of like the student in charge of the channel, which included like playing basketball, football, all that stuff.
The school news.
Yeah, school news. And then like, we would do all that. We had an actual like desk in there for like news reports and stuff like that. And it was fun. And then, you know, I started just kind of making little videos. And then the high school janitor would get so upset with me because I would be in there and he'd want to go home. And I'd be like playing with fishing line. And he'd be like, you know, my vacuum cleaner gets that stuff stuck in the motor when you when I'm sucking it up. I'm like, I'm sorry. So, so then at that point I was making videos all around my town. So I was like, I had this little garden gnome that I was making these little videos with. And so I would just like, and air them nonstop. And so then I would just show up at a business in my hometown and say, hey, I'm going to make can I make one of these in your business? And they're like, yeah, go ahead. So like, I would just show up at the bowling alley and they're like, all right, go ahead. So I was like, so I would take over a lane and just, you know, put the garden gnome on the lane and, you know, just do these things. So it was kind of fun. Those movies are probably, they're on like a VHS tape somewhere in Skylar.
somewhere in a tote.
Somewhere in a tote. But it's funny because, yeah, those were fun years. And I was working at the swimming pool at the time too, so that I would shoot one there or I'd run to the golf course and make one.
That's the beauty of a small town is, it's not like when you watch a documentary about making like a big Hollywood movie and like needing permits and doing all this stuff. Like if you live in a super small town, like where I'm from is like 1200 people max, you know, you could literally walk into the store and be like, could I, dump a bunch of blood and, you know, whatever after hours. And they'd be like, whatever,
yeah.
You know, they don't care.
Right.
That's like with this movie that we're making, we needed a video store, like an empty building. And I was planning on like 90% of the budget going to that, like having to rent a building, turn on utilities and all of this stuff. And it just turned out through weird connections and basically just asking, people were like, yeah, do whatever you want, just clean it up. So we have a location absolutely free.
I mean, and that's the beauty of making movies in the Midwest. I'm shooting a movie in June and I have the same situation where I needed a farmhouse but it can't be one that, you know, you can't just go to somebody's house and say, hey, I'm going to relocate you for a week. You know, I'm going to put you up in a hotel because you can't afford to do that. So we found a farmhouse that is owned by a lady who I actually worked with on Nailbiter. So she understands the business. She owns the farmhouse. The utilities are on and stuff like that, but nobody lives there. So you have to find kind of like, and it's all about relationships and stuff like that. I always tell people, you know, don't burn bridges because, you know, you never know when you have to go back to someone years later and say, hey, I need a favor or whatever, or they need a favor or vice versa. So it's like, I always say like building contacts, building relationships, because everybody's kind of like, well, how do you find these places? I'm like, I don't know. Like it's over the course of the years I've been able to kind of build up, you know, relationships.
You build a film family.
Right. And so there's no special formula, you know? And so I think that, cause I, you know, when we shot I Am Lisa, I think we spent maybe $500 total on locations, and that movie had a lot of locations. So it was like, well, you know, and I always talk to people out in California and they're like, how? I'm like, well, you know, a lot of these people just want their business featured in a movie.
Right.
Yeah, to them, this is an exciting thing. Like out in L.A., Hollywood, everybody's been making movies now for 100 years, so they're just sick of it. And, you know, it's like, so you always hear the stories of people making movies in L.A. and everybody starts mowing their lawns because they want somebody to come over and say, here's $50 not to mow your lawn.
Right, yeah.
You know, I think we did that on Belong to Us, though. I think somebody... We kept paying somebody to stop mowing their lawn. We were in the neighborhood of that where we were filming the family house, and I remember every time we'd start shooting, somebody would get out on their riding lawnmower, and I'm like, all right, give them a 20.
Here's a 20 and a slice of pizza. Now please kindly go inside
for two hours. Right. So, yeah. You know, but yeah, that's the great thing about the Midwest is there's excitement for it still, and there's it's still kind of got a little bit of
It doesn't just feel, it's not just a big machine, a movie making machine.
Right,
it's,
right.
There's passion behind it.
Right. So I feel like, and I just tell people it's important to make a good impression. If you go and you use somebody's location, leave it cleaner than when you arrived, you know, and be respectful to if they don't want something moved, don't move it. I always people are like, well, they're not here. I'm like, no, they said don't move it. Don't move it. You know,
Do not burn that bridge. Right. Don't cause any trouble. When that's,
yeah, I mean, because that's part of the thing is that, you know, there's a domino effect. If I go back to a location, if somebody says, hey, I need that location like this, and I say, well, I would recommend this, but we pissed them off, so now they aren't going to do films anymore. You know, like that's the thing.
Which I guess that brings me to my next question, which is such a question, like a standard ass interview question, but if you were to give like someone who wants to make a film, if you were to give a young aspiring filmmaker any advice, what would it be?
You know, and I don't like saying the typical, oh, you've got a camera, go out and film something, everybody's got a camera now. I don't like saying that. What I like to say is I always tell people, find people you enjoy working with and have synergy with and feel comfortable growing with as a filmmaker. Because I always tell people that the biggest thing I see is people are always like, I'm like, do you work with that person anymore? They're like, no, we had a fight and we don't talk anymore. I'm always like, well, you got to find people. It's kind of, you just have to find the right team, you know, to work with and grow with those people. And, you know, I work with a lot of the same people I met 15 years ago. You know, Hanum and Brown Eagle and I worked on something in 2006, and then we just shot a short last month.
He's an amazing DP. I just, you know, him and Mark Yazel, they're both incredibly talented.
Right, and I just say, just keep working with the people that you enjoy working with. You know, don't, you know, if you feel friction with somebody, and then maybe it's not going to work, you know? So I always tell people, just find those people and grow together, and you know, that's why a lot of the times these really famous directors like Stanley Kubrick, they kind of worked with the same crew because I think they felt comfortable with these people. And you know, I always say weed out the bad apples, unfortunately, because if you've got one bad apple on set, it can affect the entire production.
Is that why I haven't been?
No, that's not true. No, you're great. You're great. You're welcome anytime. You're anytime you want to come up and work on something.
You're a sour apple.
No. I've been fortunate that I haven't had a situation like that where I've had to say, okay, I can't, you know. But again, like I find those people that I feel it's a family situation, and it's almost like a. At some point, you kind of develop a shorthand with these people. You know, you work with them for so long, and all of a sudden, you're like, you're thinking what I'm thinking. Okay, let's do that. You know, and that helps. It helps in terms of if you've got like a 14-day film shoot, you don't have time to just sit there and debate. You know, like
you got to go.
You got to go, you know, because you know if you got like a very limited budget, you can't spread it out over 20 days. You'd like to, but you can't. So you have to think in terms of, okay, I have to shoot 7 pages a day of this movie and to make it to the end, you know, and not have to bring everybody back. So so you've got to have, I'm not saying assembly line like you know, but I'm saying you have to have like a rhythm, you know. And so once those people, everybody falls into rhythm, then everything kind of moves naturally and everybody can do their job. And especially on it. I mean, I dream of the day where I have like 50 days to shoot a movie. I'm like, well, what I would be doing? I'd be shooting what? 2 pages a day, a page and a half a day.
What if I told you that we're shooting our entire movie in 3 days?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
That's not true though, because you've already started doing stuff.
That's true. Yeah, I've shot some other stuff.
But you're nibbling away. That's kind of the way to go. Obviously, find the things that if they're like little inserts or establishing shots of locations. Those are things you can always grab later. I always say focus on the big picture, and if you have like a little insert that isn't going to require a grip truck to show up, you can come back for it.
Or, you know, just using fake shimps. If you got to shoot over someone's shoulder, just put the shirt on.
That's the great thing about makeup, you know, you can cover up people and stuff. But, I always tell filmmakers if they're starting out, they're always like, well, what camera should I buy? What, you know, I'm like,
it does not matter.
You know, and obviously you got to develop your skills as a writer and a storyteller and try to, get better and better with that. But I always say find people that you enjoy working with, because that spoils it immediately. If you have people you're not enjoying working with, it doesn't matter what camera you're using. It doesn't matter what script is. You're going to have problems.
Yeah.
So,
and it will be miserable.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
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 Build a good film.
Family. Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So another canned question, I guess, would be, what films or directors were your inspiration, like, for starting out? Like, what films did you watch where you were like, man, I want to make a movie?
Well, I mean, it sounds cliche, but I always, it was, you know, Spielberg and George Lucas for sure in my youth, when I was a kid. Like, I was in the Star Wars, I was in Indiana Jones, I was in the Jaws. Mm-hmm. Obviously I grew up as a kid in the, you know, 80s. So those were movies were like Big Trouble in Little China was a big one. When I was eight years old, that was like my favorite movie, Masters of the Universe. I think we talked about that a while back. I saw it in the theater. I remember I was maybe 6 years old when my parents got me like a subscription to Masters of the Universe magazine, which it cracks me up. So I had the magazine, and then I had all the toys, and they started talking about making the movie, and so like they hyped it so much in the magazine, so I was just so excited for it. I think I was close to eight when the movie came out. I was probably still seven, and that was the most excited I ever was for a movie to see in a theater. I mean, looking back on it, the movie visually holds up very well. They put a lot of energy into costumes and creature effects and the special effects and all that stuff. I know a lot of people hate that movie, but I still find it, you know, I can see it from my eyes as a kid, you know. My eighth birthday party, my parents rented the movie and I had everybody come over and watch it at my house.
That's the best birthday ever.
Yeah, I know. We all huddled around because I had a very small like TV room in my house, and everybody huddled around and watched it and stuff like that. So those are the kind of the things that kind of inspire you as early on, you know. But I think, you know, looking at my biggest influences now are probably Spielberg and Carpenter. If it was like they're two very different directors, but like, you know, John Carpenter was always a big one for me. Obviously Spielberg. You can't grow up in the 80s and not say Spielberg, because it's just kind of like, well, how can you were inundated with like everything was Spielberg, you know? It's like you had Indiana Jones, you had, you know, movies that he produced like The Goonies and
we do not speak of The Goonies. No, I'm just
that's just on your end.
You know,
I know you guys can like the Goonies. It's okay.
Gremlins. Gremlins was a big one for me because I was like, Gremlins was kind of like, it was like, Gremlins was like a gateway horror. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was and I remember when it came out, I had the stuffed Gizmo. I got it for Christmas. It was like Christmas 84. I had the stuffed Gizmo, but my parents would not let me watch that movie. So it wasn't until it came out on video in 85, 86 that I finally saw it.
You know why? The whole reason is because of the Santa Claus scene, man. Like, I, as a parent, wouldn't let my son watch Gremlins until he discovered that Santa was
there. Well, it's too late. I've already made my kids watch Gremlins.
I guess the next question is, when are you making your puppet film? When do we get...
God, I would love to. You have to come up with an idea that hasn't been, like, for me, like, okay, so the issue of Horror Hound magazine this month has Critters on the cover. And we have an article about I Am Lisa inside that magazine. And for me, I was like more excited that I had an article inside of a magazine that had Critters on the cover. Because I was obsessed with that movie. We would watch that movie all the time. The first two. And so I think if I was to do a puppet horror movie, it would be more like Critters.
Yeah. You know? See, I'm a big Critters 3 fan, which Evil still hasn't seen Critters 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And I keep pushing him, like, dude, for whatever reason, I mean, I love Critters 1 and 2,
yeah,
but for whatever reason, Critters 3 to me is so, like, it's that video store staple. I don't know,
right?
Like, you know, everyone held up in this apartment complex and Critters just fucking them all up. Like, I love the, like, us versus them motif. Like, I absolutely eat that.
I remember when that came out, because it was like 3 and 4 kind of came out back to back on straight to video, and so we rented, I remember renting those and watching them, and Leonardo DiCaprio is actually in the third one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fourth one is pretty rough, though, despite Brad Dourif and Angela Bassett being involved.
Yes, it's a little harder to get through. That was when, you know, when the franchise goes to space, you always have to worry a little bit.
Even though they're from space, too. It's like, uh-oh.
Yeah, exactly. But, I love Critters, and someday I'll probably make a killer puppet movie at some point. I don't know.
Evil and I will get in on that. We'll start coming up with killer puppet ideas.
It's so funny because I remember there were all these ripoffs. There was like Munchies and Ghoulies. Ghoulies 2. I used to watch Ghoulies 2 used to be on HBO in the middle of the day. I'd be like, you know, like nine year old kid, and I'd be like flipping on HBO, and all of a sudden, like, Ghoulies 2 would be on in the middle of the afternoon, and my parents are like, what are you watching? This isn't appropriate. HBO was...
Ghoulies 2 rules.
Late 80s, HBO was very strange. So they would be playing, like The Gate in the middle of the afternoon, you know?
That's the world I want to live in.
Yeah, and I'd be like, why is this on? And I'd be watching it. God, what else would they... Lady in White. Do you remember that movie?
I always confuse that with The Lair of the White Worm.
Lady in White was this ghost story. It had Lucas Haas in it, and God, it's so creepy. And they would be playing that like 2 p.m. on HBO. I'd be like watching it, because, you know, you just assume if it's on during daylight hours, it's okay, right?
Right.
But
and then the sun starts going down. That's when
they would play the
machetes
more,
and
right,
stuff.
Right. That's when they would start playing Friday the 13th. But it's like HBO in the middle of the day. They would be playing these movies that were probably not appropriate for kids, but I'd be watching them anyway.
Right. Well, dude, going back to Ghoulies 2, I got to blow your mind. You probably already know this, I just got William Butler's book.
Okay.
Which is, you know, the tawdry tales of filmmaking and yada yada.
Sure.
And I'm churning through this book, and I get to the Ghoulies 2 chapter, which I immediately texted Evil. I can't tell you how many times I've watched Ghoulies 2.
Yeah, right.
Hundreds, right? Did you know that entire carnival, like when they're outside and there's the Ferris wheel and all that stuff, that's on a soundstage. That's inside. They filmed all of that inside.
And they just made all the background look dark, and no kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding.
That was... They used Dino De Laurentiis' old studio. Like, he he lapsed like the payments or whatever, so Charlie Band swooped in and bought it.
Wow. And I need to rewatch it now because it's on Comet like all the time. I don't know if you guys.
I threw it on like 2 days ago,
right?
Because I read the chapter and I was like, well, I'm gonna look. And every once in a while, they'll cut to like a shot of the Ferris wheel, and if you just pay close enough attention, you'll see like a ripple in the black backdrop. I'm like, I've seen this movie so many times. I've never.
Yeah.
It tripped me out. I even had to message him. I'm like, inside, really? He's like, that's crazy, huh?
Yeah, no kidding. I had no idea. And it's so strange because it's like, what confuses me is that there's outside, there's exterior daytime carnival stuff, right? Like they're, you
right.
know, so, but I guess that you don't see the rides necessarily during the day.
Right. Man, they had all those rides inside in a warehouse.
That's insane. Like, that is insane. The part that always scared me was the part with the clown getting dunked in the water and then he came out with no arm.
Yeah. The fish ghoulie.
Right. I always thought that part was creepy, but I just remember watching it in the middle of the afternoon. I think it was probably a summer, summer 88 or 89. I can't remember the exact summer, but man, I was just like, what is this? And I didn't know there was a first one, you know. Ghoulies 2 was I watched Ghoulies 2 so many times not really knowing anything about the original. I didn't see the original.
You
know,
you don't really need to see. I hate to say that, but man, like Ghoulies
2
is one of
those movies.
I'm with
you on that. You don't need any other ones.
Yeah.
Ghoulies 2 and 3 are rad. Like,
yeah.
3 is super stupid.
Is that when they go to back to college?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Back to college. There's like Kane Hodder is the janitor like slides around right. on in that
and John Buechler directed the third one, correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
I know that Buechler and maybe John Volich and a couple other guys
right.
did, you know, the effects and stuff in 2.
Yeah.
And I'm not super up on my Ghoulies 3 knowledge.
But yeah, the first one is so different from the second one, so it's very, they almost like the ghoulies are barely in it.
Yeah.
It's a lot different. But yeah,
Mariska Hargitay.
And but yeah, the second one I always just really enjoyed. I still do. Like whenever it's on, I'm like, I'm going to leave this on.
Yep. At what age are you going to let your kids watch Ghoulies 2, though? That's the real question.
I am ashamed to admit that my kid has already watched it with me. She
hell
yeah.
Yes.
She's 8, so she's fine. Like, I'm not.
Yeah, that's good.
Mean, she's on set with me now. Like, I had her on. I had a shoot last month and over Easter weekend, and she was kind of my assistant, you know, 8-year-old assistant. my 3-year-old, on the other hand, she. Because she's always in the basement with me, and she's, you know, watching, you know, Paw Patrol or whatever, she she keeps looking over at the Halloween 3 stuff. I've got like a Halloween 3 Nika set and all this stuff. She's like, "Can I watch Halloween 3?"
Oh boy, you ruined Halloween for her.
Yeah,
you ain't ready for Tom Atkins' ass.
Yeah, she loves. She always, for the longest time, I couldn't tell what she was saying to me. I was like, "What do you want to watch?" And I'm like, "Are you saying Halloween 3?" And she's like, "Yes." Halloween 3 is a little known fact. Halloween
on your
5th
birthday.
Halloween 3 is probably one of my favorite horror movies of all time. And anyone who knows me knows that I'm obsessed with it. And I used to make people watch it in high school. I'd be like, "Hey,
dude." And now, like, here's the weird thing about Halloween 3. Like, when I was growing up, you almost got, like, laughed at
right!
for liking,
right!
you know what I mean, for liking Halloween 3. And now it's, like, it's almost trendy.
Yeah, yeah, I know. And that's the thing. It's, like, I would make people watch it in high school, and they were like, "This is terrible." And I'm like, "No, this is genius." And then now it's, like, they've got, you know, you've got Halloween 3 shirts. You've got, you go to Target, there's Halloween 3 toys. I'm like, yep. I was right. and you know, yeah, I just think it's underappreciated, but now it seems like it's one of those movies that kind of had
got a resurgence,
right?
For sure.
And I just laugh because it's like, I tell my parents whenever I'm in Target, I'm like, you know, there's a whole section of toys now for these movies that you laughed at me watching when I was a kid.
I liked it before it was cool.
Right. I keep honestly like. I used to make people watch Sleepaway Camp in high school. Like, I would make them watch that movie all the time. And I'm waiting now for, Nika has to put out a Sleepaway Camp toy at some point.
Yeah.
But I have a funny story. I have a Sleepaway Camp light switch. That you
Oh,
know,
nice.
You know,
I've seen those.
Right. Well, I had somebody recently, man, he was a electrician or I can't remember what they were. He was working on my house and he was like, "What's up with that light switch?" Because like without any context, that light switch is like, who are you? What are you? What
kind of person are you? You got bodies locked up in the basement.
So then he just kind of, I was like, "Oh no, no, it's from a horror movie. Do you like horror movies?" He's like, "No." And I'm like, "Okay, all right." And that ended the conversation. And I'm like, "Oh God, I wonder what's."
That's like the precursor for like for all of us. Like anytime a tech guy for whatever, like an electrician, plumber, whatever the hell it is,
right?
They come into our house. We're like, "Look, there's probably some mannequins and some weird shit around here. Don't think anything of it. Just go about your day."
Right.
Do not read the Latin. You know.
Yeah.
Right. But
when I had high speed internet get hooked up, and when the dude came here, you got to go through the video store to get to the back half of the basement, and he was like, "It's a lot of movies, you know, like
right, yeah, right,
kind of, you know." And then you got to like justify, like, "Uh huh."
No, you turn that into a cut. Be like, "Yeah, I got to watch these because your internet doesn't fucking work."
right. Well, I'm always kind of like, one of these days, one of these, you know, repairmen, they're going to like horror movies and then we're going to end up having a conversation. But most of the time they're like, "You are weird, dude."
Yeah. Well, and you know, one of these days, one of those repairmen, they're going to like horror movies. You're going to befriend them. They're going to be your new PA. Like, they could break into the film industry, you know, just waiting for it to happen. Right, just waiting. Right. Yeah, I don't know. I was going to say something. Evil, you got any random questions for Patrick?
I did mark down two that I was able to conjure up on a day's notice. And the one that immediately popped in my head is Mr. Ray.
Okay.
Do you have like any either a bit of film or music or anything in a media format that you use as a shorthand for like either a day where you got shit for sleep, or you're hurting really bad, or you just need to re-self-energize at least for a short period of time? Like, do you have anything that's just like a, "All right, let's go, I'm into this"?
Oh, just something that kind of get me inspired, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. You know, I listen to a lot of soundtracks.
Yes.
And it's one of those things where, like, I it sounds cliche, but I'm always listening to John Williams or John Carpenter music while I'm working. If I'm editing and I don't need to hear dialogue, I'll have score going. It's just one of those things where, you know, if I open up YouTube, it almost remembers everything that I listen to. I just click on it, you know, so it's either a random John Carpenter soundtrack or a random John Williams soundtrack, which are completely different styles, you know, like, and I love them both. So yeah, I listen to a lot of music that's just kind of get me revved up, and you know, I pop in a movie that there's all these go-to movies that I have where I'm like, this is just comfort food, you know, like, yes. You don't have to, you know, it's not Mank. You're not sitting there and trying to, you know, learn something. I'm just like, I'm going to put on a Friday the 13th movie or a Halloween movie or Nightmare on Elm Street movie in the background and just kind of let it play. And like I said, it's comfort food. You need that. Like, I'm constantly, people are kind of always asking me, how do you keep the trick to indie filmmaking? Obviously, it's a struggle to make movies. It's a struggle to stay inspired. 2020 was obviously rough for a lot of people, and trying to, you know, maintain that spark, you know, to keep working and being creative. And so I was like, okay, if you start feeling like the spark is dimming, you got to find something to watch, or even if it's a commentary track or a making of, like, something that gets you kind of, I find making of documentaries very inspiring, or like, you know, reading about the making of a particular movie. And because half the time you're like, "Yep, that happened. Yep, I agree with that." Yep.
Even, I'm telling you, even though we're all three different ages, I think we were all separated at birth somehow, some way. Like, the listening to soundtracks and the comfort cinema.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, the day before we shot our opening scene, have you seen Brutal Massacre? I think I've asked you this
before. Yes.
The comedy. I love that movie. Yes. And I watched it the day before we shot our opening scene, or 2 days before we shot our opening scene, because everything was going good. So I was like, I need to watch Brutal Massacre, you know, put myself in the mindset. And literally within 12 hours of watching Brutal Massacre, two of my lead actors out of the four who were going to be in the scene got COVID and couldn't do the shoot. Like, you know, like the whole world fell apart. Yeah. But like having that comfort food and being able to be like, okay, you know, what would Sam Raimi do?
Right,
like, I swear to God, I do that all the time.
Right. And that's, I mean, and I think that's how you keep going, you know? That's the thing, is it's like, those are the things you have to kind of latch onto and understand that when you're making a movie, shit's going to go wrong. Like, I always, it's kind of like,
everything
you, exactly. And I'm kind of like, guys, you know, what you need to be doing is controlling what you can control. Because, like, I you know, you can, you, if you come to set prepared, shot list, have a, you know, or storyboards or whatever, and you're ready to go, that way when something does go wrong, you can pivot. Because otherwise it's like one of those things where you know, you get just completely derailed, you know. And it could be something as simple as weather, or which you can't control, or an actor all of a sudden is puking everywhere. Like, it's happened to me where you're like, all of a sudden your actor is just puking. You're like, well, okay, well, I didn't see that.
I was on set that day.
Yeah.
everybody take turns.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things where it's like, you know, if you're doing low budget filmmaking, you just have to learn how to pivot from with problems. And once you figure that out, you're going to be okay, you know? And it, again, like, it's not brain surgery. You're just making entertainment. You have to, and I, Kevin Wilmot, my professor at KU, when I graduated, he just told me a couple things. He's like, maintain a sense of humor, because it's like, if you take everything so seriously, you're gonna be sad, because it's like filmmaking and independent filmmaking especially, it's tricky. And it can be disheartening at times. So you really have to maintain a sense of humor about a lot of things. And I remember that. I always think, God, I have to find the humor in something that's not working, you know? Like, you know.
Yeah, you got to roll with the punches.
Well, I remember that night that we were filming outside of that building in Kansas City, and the train. Remember that train?
Constantly.
And it was just like, I had to think, okay, how am I going to come? How am I going to think about this? How am I going to fix this problem? And luckily, we were so far ahead in the schedule that it wasn't that big of a deal.
ADR.
No. And there wasn't that much dialogue, luckily. So, I mean, yeah, we had a train that just kept stopping. And then whenever it would move, it would make this loud noise. Yeah, and yeah, it was like, oh, God, we're shooting right next to a train track. And
at like 2:30 in the morning.
At 2:30 in the morning, right. So those are the things that you just have to kind of, you know, learn to, you know. And then watching those making of docs, you hear about stuff like, or reading about the making of movies. I mean, I watched this thing last night. It was Dateline, actually. And they were talking, it was a whole episode about this girl who was acting in this independent horror movie. And they found out she murdered someone. The movie is yet to be released, but it was a document. It was an episode where it was about this girl who was charged with murder, and the filmmakers found out about it. Like, it happened in the killing happened in 2016, and then they were filming the movie in like a couple years later, and they then found out about it, and she was arrested and all that stuff. So, like,
wow,
those are the things you're like, well, you did your job, you did your casting, you shot the movie. But that's kind of a curveball you didn't see coming. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't control it.
Right. Yeah, that's the number 46 fake shimp that you got to do with, like, graduation day. You know, they cast this girl to play number 46. And then for the majority of the movie, this one girl is playing number 46. But then she didn't agree to do nudity. So randomly they switch actresses to Linnea Quigley,
exactly. Yeah. And it's one of those things where I've watched Graduation Day, and that completely went, I didn't see it. I didn't notice it.
Right. Cut to the back of the head. Do whatever you got to do.
Right.
And before Evil asks you the last question, I was going to ask you, because earlier you were, at the very beginning, you were kind of talking about film school and stuff like that. And I was going to ask you if you ever got the opportunity or chance to film at Old Father Studios.
Yeah, many times, actually. You know, we did some, I had a lot of my initial production classes in on that soundstage at Old Father, and I did, you know, various shoots. I did an animation. I took an animation class, and we were still shooting on film in the early 2000s. Yeah, because I got there in 2000, and I graduated in 2002. So I transferred from Nebraska to, I did 2 years of community college, and then I transferred to KU for my film studies. We were shooting on Old Father at the original.
That's amazing.
Soundstage a lot, yeah.
Sav actually took me to Old Father when I was helping work on a short a couple years back, and it was like, I think we were getting equipment from there,
right.
And so I just kind of got to walk around, and that's like a legendary film studio, and is it closed officially? Like, it's not.
I think that obviously the film school moved onto campus because it was off campus, and I have not. I am embarrassed to admit that I have not seen their new facility. I think they're that place is no longer in use, unfortunately.
I think we should buy Old Father Studios.
Old Father Studios.
I'm super jealous, man. We didn't shoot anything there, but I got to, you know, be there.
Right,
and,
right.
And just absorb a little bit of that history.
Yeah.
Walking around looking at posters and stuff. And
yeah, they had the Carnival of Souls poster in there because it was Centron Studios at one point, and that was they made Carnival of Souls, and actually one of the buildings that they used for Carnival of Souls was a retired organ factory in downtown Lawrence, and that's where we shot all the basement scenes for Nailbiter.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. At some point,
see,
I will make a sequel. At some point, I swear to God, the movie. I have to be able to show investors some type of
right.
You know.
Well, if you do a Kickstarter or whatever, I will definitely.
I think that might actually be the only way I can really do it. It's been so long since the first movie came out that I worry that I might have to make a sequel that's set in the same universe but with different characters. Because if somehow kind of connect to the first movie without making the audience feel like they had to have seen it, you know?
Right.
So that's kind of the dilemma. If I had made that move a sequel immediately after the first one, I would have just picked it up right where it left off. But because right. It's now been 8 years since the first movie came out.
You got to do the Evil Dead 2 remake.
I have to.
Sort of a soft remake.
Well, I have to create a whole new set of characters set in that same world, and then sort of, you know, tangentially connect it. It's a tangequel.
Yes.
You know, like I have to tangentially connect it to the first movie. And I think that's doable. I think I will do that eventually. Nailbiter 2 is going to be a vanity project. Where I'm like, I'm making this for me because I promised I would make a sequel. but it's like, oh God, how do I raise the money for it? Because the first movie, you know, like I can't go to an investor without having them say, well, how did the first movie do? And I'm like, well, you know, it played here, here, and here. It was in the red box. It was on Chiller, but they want to see
numbers. Yeah.
And that's the reality of the situation. So whenever anyone asks, well, when are you making a sequel to Nailbiter 2? I'm like, I'm like, well, I have to be able to justify it to an investor, and so that's where the issues come.
Right. Okay, Evil. So I think Evil said he had one more question for you, and then I'll just let you kind of let everybody know where to find your films and all of that stuff.
Okay, so I've tried to figure out how I was going to word this. I know it in my head, but we'll just see how it kind of flows out when I present it here. But I'm sure in doing film projects, you have read, seen, and been told about all kinds of things like, look out for this, don't do this, this could be a problem, that could end up being a problem. What's something that you've encountered on your own that you were like, did not expect that to be a problem, and then did it end up being like a funny memory about it? Or is it something you're like, well, this is time tested, now it's added to the list of things of being like, when someone asks of things that are to be avoided or to expect the unexpected, here's something that was unexpected to happen to me.
Man, that's a tricky question. I gotta have to really dig into my mind here. You know, here's one for you. When we were shooting Nailbiter in the cellar, and again, this is an important, obviously it was, you know, we shot the majority of the cellar.
Yeah, the majority of the film is in the cellar.
In 2010. Like, that's how long ago it was shot. that cellar location had a abnormal amount of bat guano inside of it. Like, it was like bat guano central, and we had no idea. And bat guano, after a while, you breathe in those the particles, it can make you sick. Mm-hmm. So we shot that first round of the movie. We shot maybe 3/4 of the movie that summer, and then we ran out of money. So we had to come back. Yeah. But after we wrapped, half the crew got sick. We're talking like really, really bad, right? Everybody thought they had the flu or, you know, the black lung. Everybody's like, oh, God. Like, I'm like, well, and it was interesting. I didn't get sick, and I don't know why, because it was funny. The people who smoked on set didn't get sick. It was like their lungs were perfectly glazed over to the point where the bat guano didn't affect their lungs. Weird.
Because they would be the ones I would think would be the first ones to drop.
Right, right. And so, like, I'm talking like we had people who were like really sick. One person had to be hospitalized. It was bad. And so I didn't see that coming. We were shooting down there. I thought everything was fine. And you knew that it was a musty basement inside of what used to be a factory, you know? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, like about, you know, right after we wrapped that first round, a lot of people were just getting sick. And I just freaked out because I was just like, oh my God, I killed everybody. And so it was like one of those things where I always tell people, I didn't see that coming, but you got to look at your locations and make sure that they're safe for breathing. Mm-hmm. When we came back down there for the second round, I made sure everyone wore masks. Nobody was, you know, unless you're acting in the scene, everybody wore masks, which is funny because it was a precursor to COVID. And so, yes. So that was just kind of an important lesson of something that kind of was thrown at me. And it threw me for a loop. I was freaking out. And luckily, everybody recovered perfectly fine. Nobody was, you know, permanently, you know, damaged from it. But it was one of those things where it's like, check your locations, make sure that they're perfectly safe. And so that was an important lesson for me and for everyone else. So when we went back there, we just made sure that everybody was wearing masks, you know?
Right. Man, that is nuts.
Yeah, I know. I was just like, oh my God. I mean, those are the things that you can just, you know, plan. And then you're like, well, I didn't expect. And, you know, what does bat guano look like? Where was it? I think it was probably in the, high up where we couldn't see it.
Rafters and stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So we just didn't know it was there. And so, you know, that was a side effect of shooting there for that long.
You might say that's batshit crazy.
It is. It was batshit nuts. I tell you, it was, you know, and luckily everybody recovered. So.
That is super fucking wild. You got super lucky that nobody kicked the bucket.
Oh God, no. And it was one of those things where everybody was, it felt like the flu, but nobody got like, or like a bronchitis or whatever, but then everybody just kind of recovered from it.
They all became antidotes for what the vaccine today is now. They just tapped all those people, be like, you have the antidote in your blood.
I was like going down the line of crew and I'm like, this person didn't get sick. What makes them different from them? I was like, oh, they were smoking the whole time. So I don't know what I don't know what that means, but it was a fact because I was just like,
all right, I'm sold. I'm gonna go buy a carton of Marlboro Reds right after this podcast,
right?
And get my immune system rocking. Right. But so as far as the final question, I can't thank you enough for coming out here and doing this and rambling and giving us a little insight to the indie film industry that we're attempting to break into. But I figured just let everybody who's listening know where to find you on all social media platforms, what films you have out now, what you're working on now. And
okay so you can find me on Facebook. I think I'm looking at myself right now here. I gotta go to, I think it's Patrick M. Ray, M as in Michael. And then on Instagram, it's also Patrick M. Ray. And again, it's REA. I know that seems simple, but it gets spelled wrong all the time. So, and then, you know, right now, all my films are like Nailbiter and Arbor Demon and I Am Lisa and Belong to Us are all on Vudu. They're on various digital platforms. Just look them up. Like I said, Arbor Demon's on Epix currently. I Am Lisa's on, you know, Google Play, Amazon, like all of them are, you can rent on Amazon.
Let me interject right quick. buy the physical media
version. If you can, that would be great. Yes. Right now, I Am Lisa's on actually in the new release section of Walmart and is selling very well. And also, you can get the Blu-ray as well. You have to order Blu-ray. Originally, I think it was going to be on at Best Buy, the Blu-ray, but I think their Blu-ray section is now like one rack at this point.
Oh, Best Buy is super sad.
So yeah,
depressing.
A couple of my newer short films, I have one called Fused and another one called Spiritual Practice, are on Bloody Disgusting TV's Roku channel.
Nice.
And they're airing on their Bloody Bites 30-minute program. And they're also on Fear Crypt, which is a YouTube channel. And I've got a couple of new short films I'm working on right now. Crockpot is one I produced, which is going to be playing at Screamfest in October. And Ty Jones directed that and wrote it. It was a lot of fun. We shot it kind of in the middle of COVID. Like, it was June of last year. So that was like my first, like, I'm handling all of COVID protocols and trying to keep everyone safe and all that.
Super
stuff.
Skeleton crew.
Yeah, it was a very small crew. We shot in a location that didn't have anybody living in it. So, yeah. And then I've got, so everything's on Vudu, Amazon, iTunes, various Google Play, all those different platforms. There's just so many now. Give them a watch, and obviously look me up on Facebook and Instagram. And I'm working on a movie that I'm a ghost story feature film I'm shooting shoot in 12 days. Gonna do that in June. Hopefully we'll have it ready to go by early next year, and I'm sure there'll be some curveballs thrown at me like we discussed. Hopefully there's no bat guano on our set. So those are the things, and yeah, just look me up and hopefully enjoy some of the films. And Nailbiter was made, and again, it came out in 2013, but we shot it in 2010, 2011. And Arbor Demon or Enclosure was shot in, God, I would say 2015. It was kind of like 2014, 2015 when we made that movie. And
right.
And then Belong to Us was 2016, 2017. And then I Am Lisa is kind of the most recent. We shot in 2019 and came out this year. So, you know, there's always a delay. Like, you make a movie and then you're like, oh, it didn't come out till, you know, for a couple years. And you're like, yeah, that's the way it works. You know, it takes,
it takes a lot of time.
It does.
We're going to push. We have three editors, and we're going to be hopefully wrapping June 6th, and we want to release it on Halloween Day.
Okay.
So, like, that's insane. So we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, good luck. I'm sure you guys are going to do great.
Yeah, definitely. Good luck, for sure. I'm so scared. But, I can't thank you enough for coming out and doing this.
I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, and I hope to see you soon and, get killed or walk by your camera sometime.
Well, I'm fully vaccinated now, so, you know, I'm hoping that, hopefully we can all meet in person sometime soon.
Yeah, that sounds like a good time. So
awesome.
All right, man, you have a good one, and we'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
All right, have a great, take care, guys.